was her contribution to the show a little bit crazy. And speaking of a little bit crazy, we have someone in here who wants to be a member of parliament. Rebecca Alty is running for the Liberals. And I can't think of another occupation where people might say, are you nuts? Are you crazy? You want to be a member of parliament?
I can see folks saying that. And I would say the one thing is folks see a lot of the online trolls or whatever, but they don't get to see all the great great meetings, the lovely people, even on the campaign trail, you know, folks providing a cookie at the door to keep you going while you're door knocking. So there's a lot of joy, there's challenges, but I think there's, you know, that's the case with a lot of jobs.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of Northerners don't know who you are. They see you, and they may see you as a Yellowknife-centric politician because you've been on council for two terms, you're the mayor of Yellowknife, and you essentially address Yellowknife issues. But now you're hoping to serve a wider region. You're hoping to serve the entire Northwest Territories. Can you just briefly introduce yourself to people in the communities who don't know you?
For sure. So I am born and raised here in Yellowknife. My parents moved here from Toronto. My dad was a small engines mechanic, so he got a job here and worked in a variety of the shops in town. Graduated from high school, Sir John, and then went off to university, got my degree in communications, and came back to work in the territorial government, not-for-profit at the Hospital Foundation, and then at Divac. And in 2012, I ran for city council, did two terms as a city councillor, and now I'm on my second term as mayor. And outside of work, I, you know, on the territory wide would be, I'm the president of the Northwest Territories Association of Communities. So that's advocating at the territorial level on behalf of all mayors, chiefs, and councillors. And through that role, I'm also on the board of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. So I have been advocating in Ottawa on behalf of municipalities for the past 5 years now. And outside of that, I think folks might know me through soccer. So coaching and then after coaching, I started to train coaches so that we had more and more coaches throughout the Northwest Territories. So a little bit about myself, and when I'm not working or volunteering, you know, out walking, listening to podcasts, and gardening. That's my joy in the summer.
Do you remember what that moment was like when you actually decided to step into politics? Because you went from, as you say, you went from Divac into being a councillor at the city.
Yeah.
What was that moment like? I mean, was there a bright light shining in the sky? Was there this flash of inspiration, I guess you could say, that said, you know, I can do something here?
I think if anybody's been involved in sports, they know how political that can get. So I had been involved in soccer, and I wanted to contribute in a different way, a bigger way. And actually, a friend asked if I'd help her, if I'd be her campaign manager, because she wanted to run for city council. And so originally I said yes. I didn't really know what it entailed, but I went to a course and learned how to run. And the woman said, you know, who's here running? Because it was about trying to encourage women to run. And we all were like, oh, I'm just volunteering, I'm just helping. And she's like, well, if none of you are ever going to run, we're not going to get more women in. And so as the election was approaching in 2012, I said, I don't see enough names on the ballot that I'd want to vote for. And so that really got me thinking. And so I decided to put my name forward. And it was because I loved Yellowknife and continue to love Yellowknife and just want to give back. And I see that, you know, council, mayor, and MP is that opportunity to give back, to help my community. And now, as, you know, putting my name forward as MP, it is about improving the Northwest Territories, which I'm also really passionate about.
And that decision to jump from the council to being mayor, I mean, must have required some sort of inner analysis and inner, I guess, reflection.
Oh, big time. Yeah. Lots of thought. And I never see it as a binary or two, you know, like, am I going to continue to run for council? Am I going to go for mayor? Am I going to... So really sat down and thought of the pros and cons and all the different, you know, situations, because I really enjoyed my job at Dyvik, enjoyed being a city councillor part-time. But I did really feel that as mayor, I'd be able to dedicate even more time to helping my community. So instead of working on stuff on the side of my desk, I'm able to do it full time. And so that's what I also see as member of parliament. And that was a hard decision too, was, you know, I love my job as mayor, and but there's also, you know, kind of limits on ways that I can address homelessness and mental health and addictions and the economy. And so that's where I was like, you know, I do want to step up and put my name forward to be able to serve in this new role.
Because when people say they're going to run for office, their friends or their family members might just look at the perks of it, and they say, "Oh, gee, you're going to start, you know, and you're going to work at this wonderfully high salary. You've got travel perks now. You've got benefits that other people aren't don't have access to." Did you think about that, or did people remind you of that when you told them you're going to run for mayor?
Yeah, actually, when I was going to run for mayor, I was going to take a pay decrease. So I did have to take a look at that and be okay with that. But for me, it's about service. And so I wanted to help my community. I, you know, with my experience on council, I wanted to step forward and be able to contribute full time. So it was something that I had to look to. And it also was a lot of time away from friends and family. So I had to consider that. So I think I had to kind of look at all the drawbacks that can come, and it can be challenging on families too. You know, I tune out the social media trolls and all that stuff, but for my loved ones, it can be difficult to see that. And so really helping them process that is like, yes, that's somebody else's comment. That's, you know, I've got to continue doing my work. I know that I'm on the right path and got to focus on the bigger picture.
Did you ever doubt yourself?
No, I think it's always like you get into these and you have to learn, but it is, I've always had some great people around me, and I've been somebody that, I guess it was in grade 5 where actually I wasn't doing very well. I was starting to roll back, and the teacher, we had to go to a parent-teacher interview, and the teacher was like, "You're not asking questions when you don't understand." And so she made me ask 3 questions a day, and it couldn't be, "Can I go to the bathroom?" And so that really got me into the question mode, and I've continued since. And so, you know, when you need help, it's turning, and there's so many people that are willing to help. So reach out if you ever are in a situation. And I think saying yes and figuring it out is something that I've done throughout life and I really enjoy.
Do you remember who it was that put the idea of running for parliament in your head? I mean, do you remember that moment that they said to you, you know, you've been mayor for, you know, quite a while, you've been on council, why not step forward? Why not move forward into like federal politics?
I can't remember specifically, but it was similar to the mayor where when Mark Hike said he wasn't going to run again, a few people approached me. And so the second and third time I was like, maybe I should think about this. And so with member of parliament too, and Michael McLeod announced he wasn't going to run again, folks were like, "Have you considered this?" And at the time I hadn't, and because I was happy where I was, but then starting to think about it and being like, yeah, that is something that, you know, I'm knocking on the doors in Ottawa, but more on the outside. And so, yeah, why not step forward and be on the inside and pounding on those doors, amplifying our message, advocating, lobbying for residents of the NWT.
Some people describe that as a very terrifying experience. Actually, the moment when they see their name on a sign that says vote for, and they see their name there, and that's when it clicks in for them. This is what I'm doing. Oh, my goodness. No, this is terrifying.
I remember driving home after winning the 2018 election and being like, whoa, this is real. I have to, because I was on leave from Dyvik at the time. I was like, I've got to quit my job tomorrow, and this is what I'm doing now. So it's always that nervous and exciting because you are stepping into to something new. It's like starting any new job. The first day you walk in, you're like, what have I gotten myself into? And yeah, a friend's up helping me this past week. And she's like, is it weird to see your face on billboards around town? And I was like, super weird. I love policy and I love helping people that like public relations or that big campaigning stuff. I don't love, but I know it's part of the job and I'll do it. But yeah, it's, you work through it and you're also just going at such a crazy pace, like 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. I'm in meetings. So I don't really have time to think about how weird that is.
So what was it about the Liberal Party that drew you to them? I mean, you had choices. I mean, you could have run for the Green Party, the NDP, the Conservatives, or even the People's Party of Canada. You could have run for any party in the world. But what was it about the Liberals that attracted you?
Yeah, for me, it was housing and the amount that I've seen invested and the recognition that, you know, you can't just put the money out. You've got to help support communities. And so, you know, with my role as mayor, I saw the support that the Liberal government had been providing to municipalities. And municipalities are the government that are providing you your core services. I always say, like, within the first 5 minutes of waking up, municipalities helped me. You know, I've had clean water to brush my teeth. I've been able to flush the toilet and it's gone somewhere. And, you know, if I had to blow my nose and throw my Kleenex out, I know it's going to be disposed of somewhere properly. And so the federal government's support for municipalities was also the Liberal government's support of municipalities was something that drew me to them. So housing and the municipal support, as well as working with Indigenous governments, you know, the direct flow of housing dollars and the more and more investment in mental health and addictions is what I appreciated about the party.
What have been some of the Liberal government's shortfalls when it comes to dealing with the North, when it comes to dealing with the three ridings here in the Arctic? What have been some of their shortcomings, their shortfalls?
I would say that, you know, previous governments, whether it's Conservative or Liberal, hadn't invested enough when it comes to housing. And so recently there has been a big investment in housing. However, the challenge is that the money's just out the door. And so forest fires and low water has meant that housing is still coming to the communities and folks aren't living in them just yet. So I would say it's always challenged the speed of government and especially at the federal level. So really want to try to find ways that we can accelerate housing.
Because the North has a very quiet voice, I guess you could say, compared to the volume that the other 300 seats have across Canada. And the issues we bring up don't seem to matter.
Yeah.
Southern Canada.
Yeah. And I do think that we do need to focus on that. Almost like a marketing strategy of the North that we're more than just snow and polar bears, which if you take a look at many countries, their Arctic strategy is either we were looking, there was about 12 different countries we were looking at their Arctic strategy and it's snow or polar bears. Two of them had people in it and two of them actually were from the Antarctic. And so that's the perception of what the North is across the world. And so making sure that when I'm in Ottawa and it's amplifying the voice of Northerners, so really making sure that we're working together and when folks are coming down that we're advocating and amplifying the messages. But it's also working to find those coalitions of other MPs. So it's not just the three MPs of the territories, but you know, if you filed your income taxes recently, you know, the Zone B, so all the Northern provincial MPs. And when I was mayor, I was working with, again, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, some mayors and chiefs councillors across Canada, and finding municipalities where we shared similar issues so that we could amplify. So it wasn't just a Yellowknife or Northwest Territories issue. Similar, like the issues that Yellowknife's facing and the issues that Sioux Lookout are facing in Northern Ontario, very similar. So really bringing that to the federal government of this isn't a unique issue. This is something that we're seeing across Canada. That's, I think, the working with other people, finding more of our commonalities versus our differences.
Because the Arctic is garnering more headlines, especially with reference to climate change. And we're looking at the prospect of having an ice-free Arctic within 50 years. I mean, those are big challenges that, you know, the government is going to have to address somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And there is recognition. And so we want to strike when the iron's hot on the support for the Arctic. And like you mentioned, the North is being impacted by climate change faster than other places. And so making sure that we have the infrastructure investment. And so our party does have a full section on Arctic sovereignty and investments in infrastructure. So looking at the Grays Bay port in Nunavut, connecting that by road to the Northwest Territories, really looking at when we're making investments for Arctic security, that it's not just what's good for the military. It's looking at what's good for communities and the military, so that we're not that we're always trying to kill two birds with one stone. One of the programs that I think really addresses so many things is the Our Land for the Future, or PFP, or there's a few different acronyms people use for the program. But that was an agreement that was signed in November. 22 Indigenous governments in the Northwest Territories, the territorial government, the federal government, as well as private donors. And so that's a guardian program where folks are going to be out on the land, monitoring the conditions, cultural revitalization, jobs across the Northwest Territories. And the importance from that climate change data collection monitoring perspective is that with Russia right now, there's a gap in the climate science of the Arctic. And the states we're now seeing decrease in funding in science. And so it's really going to be on Canada and the EU to continue to monitor and to enhance our climate data when it comes to the Arctic, since we are such canaries in the coal mine when it comes to climate change.
Because we are sandwiched between the two superpowers.
Yes.
And, I mean, any investment in the Arctic would be very, very welcome as far as defense goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So increasing support for Rangers, increasing the military staff, pay increases for the military staff, looking at changes to procurement and being able to have the icebreakers here in the Arctic, changes to Coast Guards to enhance what they can do to when they're patrolling. So a number of things that we're looking to do in that regards too, and specifically in the Arctic.
And of course, I mean, Arctic sovereignty isn't just the only issue facing the Northwest Territories. I mean, we've got housing. We have a homeless camp here in Yellowknife, something we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So given these problems, I mean, we have social ills. Satu is currently in Fort Good Hope talking about some of the issues facing their communities, which mm-hmm. they've never had to deal with before. How do you address those? I mean, how do you go forward from here? Let's assume you win. You know, if and when you win, how do you go forward with these issues and try and garner enough attention in Ottawa, a very loud and boisterous place, to be able to get something to bring back to the people in the communities?
Yeah. Yeah. The number one thing I hear across the Northwest Territories is drugs and the impact it's having on our communities, the number of deaths that have happened over the past year. And it's not acceptable. And so, again, working, it's not just a problem that we're facing in the Northwest Territories. It's actually something we're seeing across Canada. And there was a recent article on CBC about the community in Labrador, and you know, you could substitute that community's name with many of the communities in the Northwest Territories. It was similar stories of the impact that drugs are having in the communities. So really making sure that the things that we're committing to is 1,000 more RCMP, 1,000 more border patrols or customs officers. Because what it is there's an increase in cocaine production in Colombia. So we want to make sure that we're keeping our border as secure as possible to limit to stop the drugs coming into the country. Looking at making changes to Canada Post so that RCMP have a general search warrant that they can seize drugs coming through the mail. And also looking, because on the on the drug dealing side, there's always they're taking advantage of people with their addictions. So you have to address the addiction. And so making sure we're doing the investments. So one of the recent ones we did was investments with the Dene Wellness Warriors for a healing center in Fort Providence, looking to build a 60-unit facility for women and children. So moms who are going away for addictions treatment, they're able to come back and start their healing journey with their children in Fort Resolution. It's on the land healing programs. So we've got a $500 million emergency treatment fund that would be available for communities, indigenous governments, not-for-profits to be able to deliver these important services. Continuing to increase the support for the community justice programs, because that's the thing that I also heard is that people want people to be accountable for their actions and get the help that they need. So we've got drug diversion courts, so folks can, you know, if they can go through the regular court process, or they can admit that they're guilty and go to treatment. If they don't do treatment, they would go back to the court system. The benefit of the diversion is that it also means people aren't getting criminal records, which is a big issue when you're trying to get a job. And so being able to actually hold people accountable, get them the help they need, and then get them the supports and jobs after that. And to your point as well, housing is key. And so those investments to make sure that there's housing people can come back to.
You touched on a number of issues. You touched on enforcement, for instance. You touched on treatment and a number of other issues that are very important up here. Let's focus on one here.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that people considered when Donald Trump's, our famous neighbor to the south, started talking about tariffs and building walls and isolating the United States because of the influx of fentanyl into the country. And he, of course, identified Mexico as a culprit. He identified Canada as a culprit. But the reality was that fentanyl goes into the states, I think, at a rate of like 1% of what comes in through the southern border there. And the one thing that people said, well, look, if there's such a problem in the states with bringing in fentanyl, why are there so many customers in the states? You know, if you didn't have that demand, you wouldn't need the supply.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And that's not something that he's addressing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's saying, oh, we have to shut the borders down because all this fentanyl is coming in and ruining us, and we have to start with tariffs to discourage all of that, and this is why we're doing all of this economic change now. But again, it touches on the idea that if there wasn't such a demand, there wouldn't need to be the supply. So how do we protect our families and our children especially,
mm-hmm,
from the influx of things like fentanyl and meth and cocaine that seem to be coming in? And people are identifying, of course, new Canadians as being the culprits, but it's not necessarily new Canadians that are doing that. It's the people that are identifying the weakness in the communities that are bringing in these substances. So how do we protect ourselves? Just treatment centers, or is there another way to do it? I mean, you mentioned the justice system, you know, let's firm up our justice system somehow and stuff like that. So how do we do that?
Yeah, and it is organized crime. It's not just some little fly-by-night operation. And so it is tough to just put up borders to stop it because they find ways around. It's quite a sophisticated, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. They're going to try to penetrate as much as they can. So it is about trying to build those healthy communities. You know, one of the examples in Colombia as well, but in Medellin, where Pablo Escobar was, the way they helped dismantle it was actually investments in public transit and libraries and youth centers. And why was because parents was taking them 3 hours to commute to a job. So at minimum, they were away from their kids for 6 hours, which meant that drug dealers could be preying on their kids. So when they invested in public transit, people were able to get to their jobs in 45 minutes back. So they were home away from their home less. It also meant that, you know, if you're away from your home for 6 hours, you may want to turn to this other where you could be closer to your kids. And the libraries and the youth centers were those opportunities that kids could go somewhere, have a safe place, and learn and grow. So those investments in public infrastructure are key. It is about creating those healthy communities. So the other thing we want to invest is increasing funding for Indigenous healing centers, as well as friendship centers. So across the Northwest Territories, when I was visiting friendship centers, they're doing really important work. You know, in Hay River, the friendship center having the lunch hour that kids can come in. And so that opportunity that youth can come to the safe space, hopefully feel comfortable with somebody to talk about some issues, or really giving the youth outlets to avoid the temptation of going to a party, being exposed to something. And, you know, once you're exposed to crack, it can really, it can tear your life apart. So we've got to make sure that we're investing in community infrastructure.
Pierre Poilievre recently made headlines with his suggestion of three and done when it comes to justice. If you're convicted of three serious crimes, you're done. We're just throwing you into prison. We're throwing away the key until you've learned your lesson, so to speak. You don't agree with that policy.
No, and he also...
You think people have a redeeming quality that they can be rehabilitated and become contributing members to society.
Yes, yeah. And then talking to somebody, you know, they were saying their nephew got caught up, and people are scared. Like, again, this is organized crime. When the drug dealers come in and they offer somebody a little bit of money and they accept it, then they know who their family is. The threats start coming. Like, if you go to the RCMP, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And so I also think we need some of that how to get out of a gang material because, you know, parents are scared for their kids. Kids don't know how to get out of this. And when I say kids, it's sometimes 20-year-olds. But for parents, those are probably always your kids. And so it is, you know, we have seen success when people have gone through diversion instead of, you know, you go through the court system and your lawyer's going to tell you, like, don't say anything, don't admit responsibility. And then you go to jail and you meet some people and all of a sudden you're hooked in it more. You know, the other thing Pierre wants to do is change the criminal code and make homelessness a crime. And if you're in an encampment, police can come and pick you up.
That was in the headlines there yesterday.
Yeah. So I think
where he wants to just give the police the power to just go in and eliminate all these 10 cities.
Yeah, which, you know, the courts have said is a human rights violation. You can't just pick somebody up and throw them in jail for being homeless. That's not a crime, particularly
if they're violating the rights of people who expect to walk in a park in safety without the worry about having their little one pick up a discarded needle or something like that. What's the harm in that? What's the harm in protecting people? Why not just move these 10 cities to the outskirts of the city, for instance, instead of allowing them to grow and become a community at the heart of the city?
And that's where we need the investments, so that people don't have to live in 10 cities. And so when I was talking to the mayor of Sioux Lookout, there was a federal investment. And so there were about 10 people in the community. I can't remember the exact number. But they were creating about 10,000 calls for service, which is RCMP, ambulance, and the fire. Well, it'd just be RCMP and ambulances. But once they built this transitional housing, providing the support that people need, boom, we've got the decrease in calls for service. You know, folks are able to stabilize their life when you put that investment in. So we need to continue to invest in not only housing, but the services that people need once they're in housing.
What separates you or your party from the Conservatives? Because a recent survey of several newspapers came up with this, and I'll read it to you. Both parties have no plan to balance the budget in the next 4 years. Both parties, referring to Conservatives and Liberals, plan to cut the lowest personal income tax to 12.5% from 15%. Both parties plan to cut the GST on new home purchases. Both parties promised to reach the NATO defense spending target of 2% of GDP by 2030. Both parties pledged centralized and streamlined defense procurement within government. Both parties have taken opposing positions on the future of Canada's public broadcaster. Of course, the Conservatives want to defund the CBC and allow them to become a private broadcaster, hence open to market conditions, whereas the Liberals intend to continue supporting the public broadcaster. But given the similarities between the two parties, somebody in a community is sitting at their kitchen table saying, what's the difference if I vote Liberal or Conservatives? Why should I vote for Rebecca when voting PC or voting the NDP is going to accomplish the same thing?
Those are a few similarities, but I think we have more differences than that. The approach on, criminalizing homelessness for the Conservative. In the Liberal, we're really looking to increase investment in housing, having more investments in when it comes to emergency treatment, providing more support to apprentices. So that's what I heard across the Northwest Territories as well, the need for more trades. And so one of the things that the Liberal government's looking to do is to have an $8,000 grant for apprentices, as well as supporting businesses. So we recognize that, taking somebody on and training them does take time and energy, and want to appreciate and reward businesses for that. So there's also investments in Indigenous post-secondary. So for an example, here in the Northwest Territories, it could be Dachinta. So I think we actually have more differences, and with the Liberals, it is about investing in people and investing in infrastructure. So that's going to unlock more potential in the Northwest Territories. The other thing I'd say is that the Our Land for the Future, the Guardian program, the Liberal government's looking to make investments in that. We're looking to expand more Guardian programs. So I do think we have more differences. And if folks do want more information, I have it on Facebook or Instagram, or you can always reach out, and happy to chat further.
Okay. Here's another question. How vigorously are you prepared to fight for Northerners living in a small community if budget cuts are proposed that impact a program that they are reliant upon?
Yeah, no, it's really important. And when you look at the Northwest Territories, I was talking to somebody, and it's almost like a rounding error in the federal budget to be able to provide the $10,000 they need to balance the books. And so it is about advocating. It's not for spending money, it's that investment. And so that's where I think we need to change the narrative too in the North. It's, we're not asking for a handout, we're asking for a hand up, and to the hand up to unlock more potential. The federal government has acknowledged that there's been an underinvestment in the North. And so making sure that those investments in roads and energy and jobs are here in the North.
Are you prepared to break ranks with the party if they propose something that is not in the interest of Northerners?
Yeah, it's important to lobby hard. It's behind closed doors and in the public. To actually leave the party, I think it would have to be like a very...
Not leave the party per se, but stand up in public and say, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
This budget proposal you have in this document is wrong, and it doesn't serve my constituents.
Yeah, and I think it is a lot of those private meetings. So, advocating hard, but it is more behind closed doors to get the things that we need in the North. And it is about bringing others to the table to amplify my voice. So Indigenous governments, the territorial government, community governments. So really finding those coalitions to amplify the voice, I think, is the key.
Because some Northerners feel that in the past, they may have elected a yes man.
Mm. No, I think it's about fighting hard, but it's also about fighting smart, and throwing people under the bus in public isn't going to necessarily... You could win the battle but lose the war. So really making sure that I'm championing and advocating for issues in a smart way.
okay, so here I am, a northerner. We're having coffee over our kitchen table. I've invited you into my house. And I'm in a position where I can cast a ballot that could decide whether or not you go to Ottawa or not. In other words, I'm in the position of hiring you as my advocate in Ottawa. Why should I hire you?
I think because I've got the elected leader experience, so I know how to hear people's issues, hear people's dreams, because we talk a lot about, you know, people's challenges, but lots of people, you know, I want to do this, and this is the current barrier.
They say the same thing. Convince me.
Yeah, so I actually have the experience of doing that as an elected leader. And so being that bridge between residents and working the government system, it is a skill to have. And over the past 13 years as an elected leader, that's what I've been doing. And now it's taking it to the federal level. My experience of working with colleagues, elected leaders from across the country to get changes in Ottawa. We got changes for rapid housing here in the north. So continue to fight for housing. That's been something I've been working on city council for years, as well as mental health and addictions, as well as jobs and infrastructure. So it's that I've got that experience. I've been the elected leader. I can go to Ottawa and hit the ground running.
You have a minute to address the Northerners right now.
I just want to thank everybody for the opportunity when, you know, I was knocking on doors and folks were inviting me in and talking. Really appreciated that. Voting is Monday, 7:30 a.m. till 7:30 p.m. If people do have any questions, any concerns, happy to chat. You know, stop me at the grocery store or send me a message on Facebook, Instagram, email, whatever. VoteAlty.com would be where you can find more information.
Rebecca Alty, Liberal candidate for the riding of the Northwest Territories. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll see what happens on Monday, April 28th.